You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
China needs us much more than we need them.
Putin has not changed and he will not change.
People are being deliberately deprived of the very basic means to survive.
We're going to defend our democracy in the city of Chicago.
Okay, it is my absolute favourite time of the week. Time for another episode of World News Weekly. I'm Claudia Fahart here in Bangkok, and our international correspondent, Aaron Fernandez, is joining us once again. Aaron, welcome back to the pod.
Great to be back on the pod again, Claudia. This has been a massive week of international news. And in this week's pod, we'll be talking about Beijing's $7 billion parade and the guests of honour the US media is calling the Axis of Upheaval. Plus, we'll take you through what's behind the extraordinary protests unfolding around Indonesia.
Big week indeed. We're also going to be chatting about whether Thailand is headed for another political crisis after the top court sacked the Prime Minister, and how an unregulated rare earth mining boom in war-torn Myanmar is threatening to cause an environmental catastrophe across Southeast Asia.
And stick around until the end for a story about South Korea's crime-fighting holograms.
This week, China hosted a massive military parade in Tiananmen Square, marking the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Japan at the end of the Second World War. The Communist Party reportedly spent $7 billion to stage this event, showcasing its latest military technology. And it's been closely analysed right across the world. First of all, there is the guest list. Both Russia's President Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un were among those in attendance, as was the Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, the first time the leaders of those four countries have ever been in the same place at the same time. In total, the leaders of 26 nations were in Beijing for the Victory Day parade. The leaders of Slovakia and Serbia were the only Western leaders to attend. Aaron, there is tons and tons to unpack here, but let's start off with that pretty massive guest list. How unique do you think it is that these leaders all gathered in Beijing for this military parade?
Yeah, we have to start with the guest list there, Claudia. We have the leaders of 26 different nations, and some of those are among the most sanctioned and isolated countries on Earth. Now, Kim Jong-un's name leaps off the page at you. This is the first time that a North Korean leader has attended a military parade in China since the 1950s. And it's also the first time ever that Kim Jong-un has attended a multilateral international meeting. So this is a huge opportunity for North Korea to raise its international profile and for Kim Jong-un to grow his diplomatic circle among the other attendees. There are rumors that Kim may sit down for bilateral talks both with China's President Xi Jinping and with Russia's Vladimir Putin. Putin has himself been in the headlines this week. He spent the last few days in China holding talks with Xi Jinping. He visited the Chinese president's private residence, and he also made headlines alongside India's Narendra Modi when the two of them were attending a summit in China this week. They were snapped in conversation, hugging, and even holding hands.
Yeah, I feel like there's always one memorable pic that comes out of these things. But you kind of have to wonder with that shot. It was like they were standing really close together, hand in hand. I mean, it can't have been by accident, right, with the US upping the tariffs on India over their purchase of Russian oil almost seemed like, I guess, a message to Washington that, you know, we're not going to be driven apart by this.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. I mean, it is nice to distance from all of the heavy international affairs content and just focus on these two men holding hands, having a conversation. But the reality is that moment and the moments that preceded it, Narendra Modi traveling in Vladimir Putin's limousine, they're all orchestrated by those individual countries. And if we just focus on India, it's orchestrated by the Indian government to send a message to Washington that they will not cave to the pressure of tariffs that the White House has imposed.
Yes, lots of messages being sent from Beijing as well this week. China's also been using this military parade to showcase some of its new military technology to the world. What are we starting to see, Aaron?
Well, that's what it's all about. This is a huge week, not just for China, but for defense analysts around the world. So this is a moment for President Xi to show China's military might. And defense experts have been scrutinizing the preparations for the parade for weeks now. All the weapons, we're told by the Chinese government, were all made in China and are currently in service. There will be a lot of attention on their advanced missiles, given the tensions around Taiwan, the South China Sea, and other waters that China may have its sights on. When he was still a Fox News host, the US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, said that China's hypersonic missiles could sink all US aircraft carriers in just 20 minutes. Now, experts dispute the accuracy of that claim, but it clearly shows the concern through which the parade this week will be viewed. Particular attention will be on China's underwater drones. Those could pose a serious challenge to nuclear-powered subs at only a fraction of the cost. And there's an advanced missile interceptor, as well as a camouflaged vehicle carrying a powerful laser weapon. Now, one Chinese military-linked account claims it's the most powerful laser air defense system in the world. So this military parade this week is a major diplomatic moment for China, but it's also a major moment for China's military capabilities. It will have much of its arsenal, including its latest technology, on display, and that will be watched not just by governments in the West and across the world, but also by defense analysts and military weapons producers.
Yeah, a lot going on here. The official purpose of this parade obviously isn't officially showcasing the weaponry or creating a new global order with China at the center, but is all about commemorating the end of World War II. The Chinese president, Xi Jinping, has been speaking about it this week, and he said something about establishing a correct understanding of World War II. What was he getting at there?
He's trying to highlight the role that China played during World War II and trying to shift away from a narrative of that conflict that focuses on its impacts in Europe and in the Pacific. So China was at war with Japan for many years before Hitler invaded Poland. So what Xi Jinping is trying to push forward is that China was on the front lines of the conflict, that it was one of the major powers resisting fascism around the world, and that it played a fundamental role in the defeat of Japan. He's also trying to highlight that China was a productive member of the international community in the post-war environment, that it helped set up the United Nations, and that it helped establish the global world order that we've largely been living in for nearly a century now. His purpose in doing so is not just about the past, it's about the present and the future. Xi Jinping has been talking this week about establishing a new global governance order that has the United Nations and the World Trade Organization at its center. And what he's doing is he's trying to sell the story that China has been a responsible international player, and that it is right now the more reliable, the more consistent leader of the international community as opposed to the United States.
Yeah, and all that seems to have gotten the attention of the US president as well. He's been on his favorite website, Truth Social. This is something he wrote a little earlier. The big question to be answered is whether or not President Xi of China will mention the massive amount of support and, in quote marks, blood that the United States of America gave to China in order to help it to secure its, all caps, freedom from a very unfriendly foreign invader. And then, Aaron, he goes on to say, please give my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America. We know that Donald Trump tried to have his own military parade a little earlier this year. It didn't quite go off exactly as planned. Do you think he has a little bit of FOMO here with all of the leaders he said in the past that he most admires getting together without him?
It's hard to believe that he won't be feeling that way, Claudia. We know how much Donald Trump loves the cameras and loves a big exhibition. Well, the one that Xi Jinping is hosting this week has all of the world leaders whose attention Donald Trump is trying to gain on a huge, grand military scale. Now, we don't need to guess at what Xi Jinping is thinking and what he's trying to achieve out of hosting this event, because he's been telling us all week. He's been speaking about establishing this new global order all week that effectively has all of these nations like Russia, like Iran, aligning behind China. Xi describes it as a multipolar world based on an international rules-based order, but certainly with China at the head of the table. And all of this is being done with the White House in mind. He is sending a message to Donald Trump that Xi is successfully aligning these countries behind him. It's a diplomatic display, it's an economic display, and it's also a military display. And Xi is really selling the power of his country to those nations that are attending the event there this week.
Indonesia has been rocked by a wave of protests sparked by reports that politicians were receiving an increased housing allowance of nearly 5,000 Australian dollars per month on top of their salaries.
Protesters mobilised in the capital, Jakarta, as well as cities like Makassar, Bandung and Yogyakarta, setting government buildings alight and clashing with police. At least 8 people were killed during the unrest, including a delivery driver who was run over by a police vehicle. Hundreds more have been injured and more than 1,200 arrested. It's the biggest protest yet under the leadership of President Prabowo Subianto. Now, to help us understand these developments, I spoke earlier with the Indonesia Gentera School of Law lecturer, Bivitri Susanti, in Jakarta. Bivitri, thanks for joining us. Why was there such strong public opposition to the allowances and salaries of politicians? And why were those allowances given in the first place?
I think it's actually beyond the allowance itself. We have been in this period of government for only 10 months, but there have been many bad policies, and we have been waiting for better welfare. We have been waiting for promises delivered from President Prabowo. But what we hear day by day is some bad news. Every day is bad news nowadays. So public emotion, I would say, was really sparked because when we just heard that they got additional allowances, whereas ordinary people have to go through this efficiency policy by Prabowo, as well as, this economy, the whole thing has been a big burden for many Indonesians because many people lost their jobs, and then there's high inflation, and even to get a number of goods such as rice and even gasoline is pretty difficult nowadays because of bad policies from the government, we believe. But then again, we saw that directly, in the social media, in the media. So that really sparks public emotion.
So people are really feeling the strain. You mentioned that Prabowo Subianto was sworn in as president in October last year. He remains popular in opinion polls, but he has seen rolling protests since he was sworn in. Overall, are most Indonesians happy with the direction the country is heading under his leadership?
Well, I doubt that the pollings are actually accurate and with the methodology that is accepted, because there's very different point of view between what the polling says and what most Indonesians actually feel. And I'm saying that not only from my own experience, but there have been also research and surveys showing very different data. And if we can see nowadays in Indonesia, there have been disputes on data because this is something that the government has been playing with. The recent one is statistics even and economic growth that the government claims to be very high, but then immediately the economists in Indonesia and survey institutions and all that actually showed that they are completely, how do you call it, doubtful in terms of the methodologies and also the numbers. So yeah, first of all, we have to be skeptical about those surveys. We can see the tendency nowadays that many news surveys, public opinions are actually fabricated. So this is, I would say, this is quite similar with what happened in New Order era, where information is fabricated, information is controlled, so that there is this nothing bad going on in the country on the surface. But if you go, if you dig deeper and you talk to ordinary Indonesians, you go to the market, as easy as just going to the market, look for some basic needs, you will really see the difference between last year and today.
Now, protests in Indonesia often see clashes between the police and demonstrators, but what impact did that footage of the delivery driver being run over by police? What impact did that have on the protests?
Immediately created such anger, such rage of emotion, and so that the day after, the morning after, I remember the situation in Jakarta was very eerie, very different, and people had this anger and sadness and everything, so it created even more waves of demonstrations.
Now, President Prabowo promised to cut some allowances and overseas trips for politicians. Has he given any detail about this, and do you think it will be enough to calm protesters?
Not at all. He didn't give any details, and I should also remind you that in his speech, he actually talked about something totally different. I mean, in one part, he mentioned something that, oh, we are, sorry about what happened and all that. But then after that, he talked more about, don't worry, our government is very strong. We are a very strong nation, all those buzzwords that he has been saying for the past 10 months. Prabowo and also other high-ranking public officials actually haven't really touched the root cause of the problem. So they never talked about this is what we are going to do to reform the police, for example, if we want to talk about the killing of Afan Kurniawan. They didn't talk about what to do to actually have better salary plus allowance scheme for high-ranking public officials, because that's also something very unique in Indonesia, because they actually have small salary, but they have so many types of allowance.
What is the mood like in Jakarta right now? And given the issues that you've just described, where do you think this protest will go from here?
Many are very afraid, especially those of Chinese descent and all that, because we still have very strong memory of 1998. Plus, because the 1998 occasion at that time was never tried. I mean, we never had any human rights trial or anything that actually opening the truth what happened in 1998. So we still have impunity, and actually people who who were involved in 1998 are now the high-ranking officials, including Prabowo himself.
Vivitri Susanti, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
And Aaron, there's been a big story unfolding here in Bangkok this week. The Thai Constitutional Court sacked the Prime Minister, Paetong Tan Shinawat, leaving the country headed towards what's looking like another political crisis.
Yeah, that's right, Claudia. So this case all goes back to a phone call that she had with the former Cambodian leader Hun Sen back in May, where Paetong Tan referred to the former Cambodian leader as uncle and offered to, quote, take care of anything that he needed. Now, she also made critical remarks about a Thai military commander, which can come with fatal political results in Thailand. We've seen that before. And then last Friday, the court decided that she had violated ethical rules, officially ending her term as prime minister only about a year after it began. Claudia, what's the mood over there in Bangkok about what could happen next?
I think the feeling, any way you look at it, Aaron, is that the outcome is certainly going to be prolonged period of political instability here. The Thai constitution has an interesting rule where anyone who is going to step into the post of PM after, you know, a PM is stood down or vacates the post has to have been nominated as a candidate for PM at the last election, which was back in 2023. So there were only, across the parties, 9 people nominated for PM. 4 of them, including Paetong Tan Shinawat, have now been ruled ineligible. And there's only actually one left from her party, the Pheu-Thai Party. He had a stroke on the campaign trail, and he's been surrounded by rumours of ill health ever since. The party insists he's great, he's good to go, and they want him to be the next prime minister. But no one's really confident that that is a good decision right now. So other major parties are all currently jostling for power. It's almost certainly going to come down to whoever the People's Party decides to back. And we've just heard from them that they will be backing the Bumjai Thai Party, which is the Pheu-Thai's major rival in the parliament. The People's Party is the pro-democracy, progressive party that won a third of the seats at the last election that many argue should be running the country but was blocked from forming government, or the latest iteration of that party, I should say, after they were also dissolved by the same court. But the thing is that the People's Party has already said that anyone that they're going to back to be prime minister has to agree to dissolve the parliament within the first 4 months, because they say this government just can't continue in its current form. It's obviously not functioning correctly. It's not representing the Thai people correctly. They want to see a return to elections. We could get there one of two ways, that the People's Party backs Bumjai Thai and they call a dissolution within 4 months, or what's looking more likely now, we've just heard that Paetong Tan Shinawat's Pheu-Thai Party has just sought royal approval to dissolve the parliament right now before the Bumjai Thai Party can even put their prime minister in. So either way you look at it, Aaron, it looks like we are going to be headed to elections at one point or another. They weren't due to come until 2027. They'll probably now happen later this year.
This is the largest environmental crime I have ever experienced. The contamination can go all the way to the South China Sea too, and affect 60 million people along the way if we allow this to happen.
So while we're talking about Thailand, I'm sure each and every one of our loyal listeners catches every episode of SBS World News. But if you didn't this week, Claudia has just returned from the Thai-Myanmar border, where some of Thailand's northernmost communities are sounding the alarm over an unfolding environmental crisis. They've discovered dangerously high levels of arsenic flowing through their rivers, and experts believe it's being caused by a rush for rare earth minerals across the border in Myanmar. Claudia, you've just returned from the border. What's happening in these communities?
Yeah, so these are incredibly small, remote villages sort of dotted along the Thai-Myanmar's northern border, Thailand's northern border with Myanmar, all the way up to the Mekong. And these communities, firstly, it's like incredibly beautiful place to visit, right? The landscapes are incredible. But they live a very agricultural life. Like everyone in these communities, in one way or another, depends on these rivers for survival. They'll either be fishermen, they'll be farmers, some make rafts to sell for fishing, for tourism, things like that. So there really is no life in these places without the rivers. Earlier this year, they started noticing the river was turning a really odd shade of orange. And then people who were going in it started to get rashes that just were really painful and wouldn't go away. Fish were washing up dead, and they started finding fish with deformities. And elephants that they've always taken into the river to cool off started getting odd skin diseases as well. They've now done 8 rounds of water quality testing, and they've found dangerously high levels of arsenic, in some cases 5 to 6 times the safe limit that's set out by the World Health Organization. At first, they thought that it was gold mining, because we know from gold mining that arsenic often ends up in waterways. But then they found these satellite images that showed what looked like 2 new rare earth mining sites further upstream in Myanmar, where these rivers originate. So far, it's in 3 rivers, the Kok Sai and Ruak rivers, and they all flow into the Mekong, which is obviously Southeast Asia's most important waterway. And the big problem now is that they're starting to detect arsenic in the Mekong. So environmentalists are warning that this really could go all the way through not just Myanmar, Thailand and Laos, but also further down into Cambodia, into Vietnam, potentially to the South China Sea, where the Mekong empties, if this isn't contained. And if that happens, it would just be a catastrophe. I mean, this is a river system we're talking about that supports 60 million people right through mainland Southeast Asia. I was speaking to some fishermen close to the Mekong in Changsen who rely on this river, right, for their daily catch. They said they've started finding deformed fish. They sent some away from testing and they came back and showed high levels of arsenic. So word has already gotten around, and even though the government is still insisting the rivers are safe, the fish is safe to eat, people aren't willing to touch it. There is so much fear about what it could do to their health, right? We know that long-term exposure to arsenic leads to all sorts of diseases like cancer. It has a correlation with developmental problems in newborn babies. So far, Aaron, we don't have evidence. It's gone too far down the Mekong. But scientists do say that this thing is often delayed because when you talk about arsenic and heavy metals in water, right, it doesn't move as quickly as water does. They're in little particulates, like little sediments, and they kind of slow down and speed up and slow down and speed up. So they think what we're seeing now is a delayed effect from potentially a year ago, right? So if this mining continues, they say, it's only going to get worse, and it absolutely has the capacity to spread through the region. We've spoken to fishermen who used to make 1,000 baht a day, and they're now making 300 a week. They just can't sell their catch. So for them, they feel like if this isn't fixed, how are they going to survive? It really comes down to that. It's about their very survival. That's how much these communities rely on these waterways.
And if you missed that story by Claudia from the Thai Myanmar border, you can catch up on that and many others at the SBS News YouTube page.
Okay, time for a look at some of the other big stories happening around the world this week. Fresh from their break, a US congressional committee says it's released more than 33,000 pages of files on convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. An Ipsos poll in July found that the majority of Americans believe the government is hiding details on the case, mounting pressure for more disclosure. But the top Democrat on House oversight found 97% of documents released were already in the public domain. The materials apparently include videos of police interviews with the victims.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has declared that Moscow has never opposed Ukraine's potential membership of the European Union, and that he thought it was possible to find a consensus on ensuring the security of both countries. Speaking in China, Putin said Russia had been forced to act in Ukraine by what he cast as the West's attempt, with the help of NATO, to try to absorb the entire post-Soviet space. However, a map spotted in Russia's Ministry of Defense appears to show Russia's claiming 2 more Ukrainian regions that they haven't yet seized, Odessa and Mykolaiv. Not exactly a conciliatory sign.
After nearly 50 years, the UN Security Council has voted to terminate the peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, bowing to demands from the US and its ally Israel. The interim force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL, will be wound down over the next year in a bid to prevent what it calls a dangerous security vacuum further destabilizing the region. The mandate for the force, which includes Israeli withdrawal from Lebanon and the disarmament of Hezbollah, has never been achieved, though diplomacy through the US continues.
Drop it! Dead or alive, you are coming with me.
A chilling warning there to all criminals from 1987's RoboCop, an iconic film about a cyborg policeman deployed to clean up the streets of a dystopian Detroit. But while RoboCop terrorized gangs across the Motor City, South Korea now has their own high-tech law enforcer walking the beat.
Walking the beat might be a bit of a stretch, but yes, Seoul does have a new sheriff in town, and he is a life-sized 3D hologram. Since October last year, a video projection of a uniformed officer has kept watch over the city's Jeodong Park in a bid to deter nighttime robberies and drunken violence. Now, this hologram can't make any arrests, but he is armed with an AI-powered camera and a recorded message warning would-be lawbreakers that nearby police will be sent in case of an emergency.
That's terrifying. And while he doesn't have the same lethal force as RoboCop, local police say that Hologram Cop is actually working pretty well, Aaron. They say that crime in the park has reduced by 22% since he was installed. I mean, that's not bad. It's also worth noting that Seoul is generally considered one of the safest cities in the world. Nevertheless, the area's chief of police is a big fan of his holographic deputy, saying his mere presence is enough to make people think twice before committing a crime. Imagine what a holographic RoboCop could achieve if we combined them, Aaron. Maybe worth suggesting an upgrade.
Indeed, indeed. I wonder what they're calling this hologram officer. Does he get a name? Does he get the gold watch after 20 years of service, like other officers typically do?
I think this is an investigation for us for next week. If you'd like to hear more, do be sure to join us then. That is The World This Week. If you're enjoying the pod so far, be sure to like and subscribe for new episodes each week.
And drop us a comment if there's a world news story out there you'd like us to cover.
Aaron, as they say here in Thailand, Sawadee Ka.
Namaste, Claudia.